Welcome to another edition of Geopolitics and Empire. A quick reminder to support this Rebel transmission. Best way to do that is become a paid subscriber on the Substack. $5 a month, $50 a year. We're doing member-only calls every week or two and things like that. You can also buy me a coffee and send reinforcements through DonorBox. We're joined today by James Bovard, who's the author of 10 books. He's written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Playboy, Washington Post, many other publications. And his latest book, I've got a copy right here, The Kindle, Last Rights, The Death of American Liberty. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Hey, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate that.
I've been following your work for a number of years now, and perhaps for listeners who are new to you, if you could just, anything you want to tell us about yourself and the arc of your work over the years.
Well, I've never been indicted. I've been writing, over 40 years, doing a lot of investigative type work, trying to help people recognize how oppressed they are becoming, how misgoverned they are, how dishonest politicians are as a class, and how so much of the economic medicine the government injects is actually poisoning the entire society. I've been able to survive because I found enough editors that like the stuff I do, and here I am.
Your work really resonates with me because, I'm originally from Chicago, the U.S., and for 20 plus years, I studied and taught history, international relations, political science, and I've been seeing what you've been detailing. I've been seeing this grow, this tyranny for decades now. I decided for different reasons to expatriate from the United Soviet States of America, as I like to call them, but you start off your book. Let me just read a quote here. You say, Americans today have the freedom to be fleeced, groped, wiretapped, injected, censored, injected, ticketed, disarmed, beaten, vilified, detained, and maybe shot by government agents. Politicians are hell-bent on protecting citizens against everything except Uncle Sam. Is America becoming a cage keeper democracy where voters merely ratify the latest demolition of their rights and liberties? And it's not looking good. What's your sort of assessment of where America is at?
Well, you didn't bring me on the show for positive thinking. So it's frustrating because, these are things I've been writing about for a long time, and you're kind of sounding the warning alarms, and, it doesn't have, it seems to have almost no impact. There are a lot of Americans who are recognizing how the political trend line is disastrous both for freedom and prosperity, but maybe not enough to stop the train from going over the cliff. I don't know. There was a book I did, 18 years ago called Attention Deficit Democracy. And it's funny, there was a lot of people felt I was way too cynical back then. Some of them don't feel that way anymore. So to see the level of crime that the government gets away with. And there's no way to help hold it accountable, it seems. And most Americans are whistling past the graveyard.
It is. And I'll start maybe from the end of your book, and then we can touch on other topics, but something that, it affected me personally, and many Americans, as you said, some are waking up, others are still asleep. But you talk about the surveillance state, free speech, ministry of truth, basically the criminalization now of thought and speech, like in Orwell's 1984. You talk about Nina Yankowitz of the Disinformation Governance Board, when that happened that week, April 2022, I remember that because you talk about, for example, how in 2018, the Congress created a new federal agency, CISA, Cyber Security Infrastructure Security Agency, in the DHS. And you write that CISA realized that it would be politically and legally perilous to directly muzzle Americans, so it relied on censorship by surrogate. And so that week, CISA, DHS, deplatformed me from PayPal together with
Consortium. Really?
Yeah, Consortium News and Mint Press News. And you referenced Matt Taibbi. He actually reached out to me and covered my deplatforming, and so did Kim Iverson.
Well, that's great.
But just to think that, yeah, I didn't lose any money, but the point is I can't believe still as a U.S. citizen that this is now happening, that some of us are, you know, experiencing the first steps of being sort of labeled as enemies of the state. Others are getting debanked. Others are being jailed. So your sort of thoughts on this apparatus?
Well, it's interesting. Back in the 1990s, I think people saw me as a moderate libertarian because I was critical of most of the government programs, but I wasn't sounding radical. And then after 9/11, at least inside the Beltway, so many of the libertarians went to the other side of the barricades and started cheerleading for George W. Bush or war with Iraq or the entire war on terror, load of BS. There was a sea change, and I didn't change my principles. So pretty soon I was, being blackballed a lot of places, or being an outcast or whatever. But story of my life. There was a bellwether. The Attorney General John Ashcroft testified before the Senate Committee, I think Senate Judiciary Committee, in December 2001, about 3 months after the 9/11 attacks. And he said, those who frighten Americans with phantoms of lost liberties are giving aid and comfort to the enemy. So basically, he was saying that people who complained about the government violating freedom were traitors. That set the tone for the Bush administration. I think the same tone has carried over for a lot of things since then. I think it's revived. The Biden folks are playing that storyline far more than what we know. Far more than what we know. I mean, as an investigative journalist, folks say, well, it's great you found this, you found that, and you found this. And I'm thinking, shit, most of the rabbits get away. Most of the outrages, I'm not able to nail down. Sometimes I get a piece of this, a piece of that. It's like, I know there's a whole lot more, but, the federal secrecies usually say, most government cover-ups succeed. And, there's the alternative storyline is that truth will out. Well, if the government's, classifying trillions of pages of documents a year, that's a lot of truth to out, and it's not going to happen. So,
yeah, we continue, all of us, to do what we can to pay attention, to speak out. I had Ron Paul on the podcast late last year, and he was it late last year? I don't even remember, but he was saying we're pamphleteering. We have to. There's a remnant. We have to keep speaking. Truth eventually will win. I don't know if we will, but nonetheless, we just keep on trucking. And there, you cover a lot of stuff in your book that many people are not aware of. And one of the, I think in your first or second chapter, you talk about civil asset forfeiture, which is absolutely insane. And I'm down here in Mexico. I've also become a Mexican national, and we see transit police often. I've been extorted by transit Mexican police. You've got Mexican police who kidnap citizens, authorities. And so, that's going to one extreme, but, they also steal from citizens. And the same thing is happening in America. And Americans don't, they'll look at Mexico and point the finger, but they have no idea. The same thing is happening in the United States. And it's just, you detail it. You talk about how the government in the U.S. now is entitled to confiscate any car or truck that exceeds the speed limit. So if they wanted to, you talk about how the TSA and DEA agents can confiscate the cash of any domestic traveler, that, they've got like a $5,000 threshold. And you say how in New Mexico, police have seized the equivalent in Albuquerque of one vehicle for every 25 households. My hometown in Chicago, you say police have impounded more than 250,000 vehicles since 2010. It's absolutely insane. The thoughts on, for example, civil asset forfeiture.
Yeah, it's a topic like that almost makes me cynical. It's amazing to see how that the forfeiture, which basically gives the government to confiscate private property even when it does not file any criminal charges against the owner, the government can simply make make an allegation or even simply write a memo, and voila, the government takes takes control of the property. And if the private citizen wants to get it back, the citizen might have to spend $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 in lawyers' fees. Most of the seizures are less than that, so the person is screwed. And many of the victims, if not most of the victims, are relatively low income and don't have a couple extra $1,000 to hire an attorney. So it's fine to see how the legal doctrines have proliferated to prop this up. There was a case I wrote about for Playboy back in the 1990s, and it was a landmark case on forfeiture. It involved a steel worker who was driving home after working at the factory, picked up a prostitute in the Detroit streets, pulled over, and as the, you know, that was a delicate time. The news story said that the police came up as she was performing a sex act on him. And so there was a statute in Detroit that said if someone was caught with a prostitute or in the act of sex in their car, the police could seize the car. And it's just, you know, game, set, match. Turned out the car was co-owned by Tina Bennis, who was the steelworker's wife, and she had not approved of him using the car that way. And so, and it was funny. You had the Clinton administration Justice Department saying, basically blaming the wife because she did not do everything that she could to prevent her husband from using the car to pick up a hooker. And that was shortly before the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So, but and it was fine to see Americans think their rights and liberties are safe because of the Supreme Court. What does the Supreme Court do with this case? Chief Justice Rehnquist upholds a seizure based on a parallel to, I think, an 1823 seizure of a Spanish pirate ship that had been attacking American ships in the Caribbean. And the doctrine there was that as soon as that Spanish ship did the attack and violated the law, it was forfeited. Well, and the same was true of that Pontiac that the government grabbed. But he had this idiot decision, there have been so many opportunities for the Supreme Court to pull in the reins on this tyranny. Because, as you said, if you're flying with more than $5,000 in cash, boom, SOL. And it's up to you to somehow prove you got the money innocently. And there are so many ways that they rig it. For instance, going back 40 years, the police have brought in police dogs to sniff currency to see, oh, it has a trace of drugs. Well, the government knows that if you got a large $100 in bills, whatever, some of that's probably going to have a trace of drugs. So it's an automatic alert, automatic seizure. I mean, a lot of judges have said, hey, this is complete BS. The government keeps on doing it. So it's maybe not as bad as the Mexican transit police, but it's not much better.
No, I mean, I was shocked a couple of years ago, the report that, you know, they compiled the amount in the United States of robberies that took place, you know, assaults, home burglaries, yep, or whatever, and that the amount stolen by U.S. authorities and police from citizens through civil asset forfeiture was greater than criminals stealing. And, you know, you detail as well in your book, like they're confiscating homes from people for no reason. People didn't do anything. They're taking your house. They're taking your cars. They're people selling, life savings of an old man. You know, the daughter is, you know, $50,000, going to take it to put it in a bank account in on the East Coast. And they just take it from these Americans. And you mentioned in the book how that there was a law authorized that authorized 3 years in prison for individuals who allegedly make frivolous legal claims to retrieve their seized property. So if you're trying to defend yourself, you can still go to jail. But my question here becomes, you know, I've never experienced this as an American. I don't personally know anyone who has, but as you detail, it's going on in mass. So how do you sort of square the two? It's kind of like here in Mexico. You know, I've been living here for a decade. We got the issue with the cartels, but if you kind of mostly mind your own business, you won't have a problem. So it's kind of like, I'm fine, but all around me, this madness is going on. Any thoughts on, you know, how this is going on, but, you know, for many Americans, we've never seen, experienced
that. Well, I think the total number of people who have been hit by asset forfeiture is now well over 500,000. And I mean, as a journalist, I've talked to some of these folks. They are out there. A friend of mine, Dan Ullman, has done some of the best legal work fighting this for the Institute for Justice. It might seem like an abstraction, but it's this is not some fringe that it's just for hippies wearing tie-dyed shirts. I mean, a parallel on that would be TSA. I don't know what the airport security procedures are in Mexico, but I would bet they aren't as bad as TSA. And, you know, I've had a lot of clashes with TSA. I mean, maybe it's the beard. Maybe it's my, after effects of my redneck upbringing. I don't know, but I get some. I've had some tussles with those folks, and I've had to settle accounts in print. It's been very sad.
Do you I used to back in the day, not any longer, but do you opt out of the, as I like to call them, and I know you referenced them.
Do I opt out? That's a great question. I was doing that for a while, and then I was flying out of Portland, Oregon in Thanksgiving morning, 2015. And so I was, I was opting out, and the TSA dweeb comes up and does a test of my hand and said that it showed positive for a trace of explosive. And I said, well, which explosive? He says, well, I don't know. The machine doesn't tell me. And I later checked, and, the most common explosive these machines discover is hand sanitizer and soap, because glycerin triggers the alarm. So they have these endless false alarms. But so I marched off to a private room, and this TSA agent tries to turn my family jewels into a pancake. And, I was kind of irritated by that. And there was some testy back and forth of those guys. And then I got back and did an article a couple of days later for the Washington Times talking about this, about the, total BS there in Portland. And then I waited a few days, and then I filed a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, to find out how the TSA had responded to my article. And there are all these memos back and forth. And yeah, this is a problem we've been having there in Portland. We've had a lot of complaints on this. And best of all was the statements by the three guys that marched me off to the private room. And they were saying, well, he said he was a blogger, and I don't know anything about that. I was thinking, no, I didn't say I was a blogger. I said I was, that I wrote for USA Today, that I was on their board of contributors. But, these guys were dumb. And it's like, it was kind of like, you try to give them a warning, and it's just like, no, we're going to do this. And I mean, it was obvious bullshit, because if TSA thought I was actually a threat, then the people would have reacted completely different. So like, yeah, well, here's some asshole who opted out, so let's take him to the private room and work him over. But I managed to get some of the videos from that day from FOIA, and followed up with a USA Today piece on that walked through what the TSA did and their rationale. It was 2 years later. I was going to a Mises conference down in Auburn, flying out of National Airport in D.C. And the I'd given up on opting out, and I was walking through there. I figured I'm not gonna have any trouble with this stupid whole body scanner. And but I forgot to take off my belt. So, you know, so there's an alarm and it has this big screen they have. And the guy points, see, there was something there very suspicious right here in midriff. And it's a small belt buckle, but it was about 6 inches wide and 4 inches high. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it's not that big. But so the TSA agent comes up and he starts saying, well, I've got to do this and got to do that. And so I says to the guy, look, if you jam my balls, I'm going to file a complaint. And he gets all flushed. He says, I need a witness. And I was just, and some big old bulky guy, a senior TSA guy comes out wearing a white uniform. And he says, I'm here to be the witness. And so I said, well, you know, where's my witness? You know, and he says, it's going to be videotaped. It's on videotape. I said, is there an audio tape? He says, That's sensitive security information. I said, security theater is what it is. So we went back and forth, and I later did a piece for the Los Angeles Times on this, and it got syndicated. One of my favorite headlines was at Minneapolis Star Tribune that said, TSA, the world's most stupid agency. So, you know.
It is theater. You know, I used to opt out back in the day, and I think Americans should. I wanted to test the limits of our freedom, and I would wear my 9/11 was an inside job T-shirt to the airport and opt out. But then, as you noted, they try to intimidate you. They almost, you know, they intentionally hold you for longer. I almost missed my flight, and so. But you know, just looking at then at the bigger picture. How would you describe what kind of system we're in? Because it's definitely not freedom, liberty, democracy. It's not full on, you know, North Korea or something like that. It seems more like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where it has this veneer of democracy, but really is totalitarian at heart. You know, how close are we from shifting from the United States of America to, as I like to say, the United Soviet States of America?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of individuals who are pushing back. There are some good members of Congress and most of the Republicans. There were some Democrats who have been good on some issues. There were some Democrats that supported the fight to reform FISA this week. I don't know. I mean, it's frustrating. It's been over 40 years since we had a major party presidential candidate who made individual freedom a key tenet of his campaign. Ronald Reagan in 1980. Biden is certainly not going to do that. Trump might have a few phrases, but that's not his message. I guess part of what concerns me is to see the loss of passion and faith in freedom, especially among younger people. There was a poll I mentioned where like almost a third of people in their 20s would support mandatory government surveillance cameras inside private homes to prevent domestic violence. And my view is if someone supports that, then, you know, they're lost forever. If they're that stupid and that servile, then it's just, it's a question of triage. There are a lot of younger folks and middle aged and even geezers who might be able to see the light, but when you've got someone who's just so folks wanting to have mandatory surveillance cameras in private homes, I don't know if that's more Huxley Brave New World or Orwell 1984 or Stalin 1930s. So.
Yeah, you know, that is an important point, which I brought up, and so I have guests that the young generation is key. You know, we can talk a bit about the COVID and the QR codes and the digital passports. That cashless system, they need the buy-in from the youth, and if they get it, we're screwed. But, you know, you also talk about guns. You've mentioned in your book how many rural gun owners are as unlikely to surrender their guns as they are to give up their Bibles, and you conclude that chapter by saying private firearm ownership is the last best check on tyranny. Banning firearms is a declaration of war on all limits on political power. Politicians who probably seek to destroy the Second Amendment cannot be trusted to respect any other constitutional writes, the civil disobedience of peaceful gun owners is one of the best hopes for the survival of American liberty. But you detail in your book, they're trying to go after the guns. Many countries around the world have had their guns removed, their gun rights. And it feels like this would be the final straw. If they could take away Americans' guns, it's over. How do you see them being able to do that? Because there's so many guns.
Well, that brings to mind a story of when I was suspected of being a undercover FBI agent. I was traveling in the mountains of Western North Carolina. This is the summer of 2001, shortly before 9/11. I was traveling with my wife at that time, now ex-wife. And, there was dangerous situations where the wife has a tourist book. And she says, oh, there's a nice little chalet way back in the mountains. So, of course, we're trying to find the damn thing and not finding it. So I pulled in front of this hardware store in, Whittier, North Carolina. And I'm just kind of, I was standing there firing up a cheap cigar, looking at the map. And this big old bald guy comes up, strutting out of the hardware store. Says, what part of Maryland are you from? And so, because I had Maryland plates, and he starts chatting me up. And then after about 10 minutes, he admits he thought I was undercover FBI. And I said, look at me. Do I look like undercover FBI? Jesus. I mean, the beard was a little bit red back then, but anyhow. So I said, well, why do you think I'm undercover FBI? He said, well, you're driving a black car. Yeah. And you got Maryland plates. And I said, well, are there any other signs? And he says, there's these feds always have got like these trackers, GPS trackers hidden under the back of their car. I said, why don't you take a look? So he climbed under laid down, got his arms under there, checked, couldn't find anything, got up and shook my hand, says, I guess you're okay. So I started shooting the shit with this guy. And it turns out the reason he was paranoid was there had been around 200 FBI agents in that area a year or two earlier looking for Eric Rudolph, who was the abortion bomber and the guy who allegedly did the 1996 bombing at the Atlantic Olympic Games. And he was hiding up in those mountains. And the FBI came in there. Once the FBI heard he was there, the FBI made a big announcement and they sent all, they announced they were sending their best agents there, and 100, 200 FBI agents came in, and they came in like they owned the place. And there was a motel there, and they came in and threw all the people out who were staying there, and they took over this, and they took over that. Well, they got no cooperation from the local people or the local officials. And the FBI never found Eric Rudolph. He was found a year or two later by, I think, a deputy sheriff. But it struck me that, okay, you got Washington, D.C., you got Congress, you got these officials. We're going to force America to do this. We're going to force America to do that. They have no authority in the mountains of Western North Carolina. And that's compounded now because, well, it was similar. I wrote a lot about Ruby Ridge. And people forget that the feds at Ruby Ridge were terrified that they might be encircled by gun owners and other people that were upset about what the feds were doing, killing the mother, holding the baby, and stuff like that. And it struck me, especially with things like the Barrett 50 caliber sniper rifle. This is armor piercing at a distance of up to 2 years. This basically means that the feds don't have jurisdiction in these areas if the people don't support them. I mean, there was Congressman Swalwell said that the government could enforce gun control with nuclear weapons. Yeah, I don't think that's going to work so well either. So, there's a lot of government officials and politicians who would like to totally destroy Americans' rights and freedoms and guns. But a lot of parts of this country, they simply won't have the authority, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. What's your impression?
I don't know. I ask this question often. I find it difficult. They need some sort of chaotic scenario. Maybe I'll just ask you this question now, since it kind of relates. You got this movie coming out, I think it just came out, Civil War, and it's there are these whispers from Washington. It's almost like some are interested in pushing this narrative. There's just talk of a second civil war. And so I'm wondering, you know, maybe in that sort of environment, that could create a pretext or way to take guns. But even with some, you know, huge event like a second civil war, I still would find it difficult that guns would be given up. Do you have any thought on this idea of things that might, the chaos that might transpire this year in America?
I don't think it's going to transpire this year. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there are scenarios where the entire, you know, political election could go to pieces. For instance, if Trump is arrested and put in jail and then has a similar kind of incident that Jeffrey Epstein allegedly had. I mean, all these Democrats are clamoring to have Trump arrested and put in jail. I mean, that is very perilous. Because if something happens to him in jail, then boom. I mean, you talk about paranoia and anger. I don't think, I mean, and again, going back to, you know, I was raised in the mountains of Virginia. And, you know, folks there, you aren't going to take away their guns. I mean, they will kill you first, or they'll get killed trying to preserve their guns. I mean, there was a fun line I had in there talking about the situation down there, down in New Zealand. And so you had, I guess there was a big shooting, and the prime minister, who later had a mental breakdown, was out there seizing guns, banning semi-automatics or something like that. I'm not quite sure the extent. And then shortly thereafter, then COVID came and they announced they'd be having these quarantine centers for people who didn't obey this or that edict. And somebody quipped that, well, it was less than a year between the time that they seized the guns and they created the concentration camps. And that's a little overstated. But then you've got the vaccine mandates coming down. I mean, I've forgotten the details in Australia and the quarantine centers there for COVID. But I mean, these are supposedly civilized Anglo countries. I mean, flip side, Britain has been an absolute disaster in civil liberties. Most Americans, you know, things are bad here, a hell of a lot worse in Britain. Plus, there isn't an ethos there. There are a lot of individuals in Britain who are gung-ho pro-freedom, but I mean, to see what the government gets away with, to see what they've done on social media, arresting people, it's like, and it's a strange thing. Pardon my tangent here, but, you know, all this, the thing they have now in Scotland, I guess, is it what, 2 or 3 years if you misgender somebody in jail? And I was thinking about it last week. There was someone didn't like something, an article I'd written on Twitter, and the person said I was a Nazi stack of steaming shit. And it's like, okay, it's Twitter. It's Twitter. People, you know, people are going to say that. And if I'm so sensitive that I'm going to feel that I need to call government intervention, then I should shut the hell up and never write again. I mean, part of being in a free society is having some thick skin, getting the insults, being vilified, and then, you know, laughing it off and, you know, okay, well, let's hit this agency again. Let's hit this issue again. Sure. I mean, it's nasty, but, you know, life is often nasty. So,
yeah, I mean, I have that same attitude. There's virtually nothing anyone can say to me. I've been insulted, as a result of this podcast, and I'll even quote tweet or retweet the insult against me. Like
it's comic.
Yeah, you make a joke out of it because it's false. It's a slander, and so that's how it should be. I it doesn't get to me, and that's how we should be developing that strength in people. That you know, sticks and stones. How's that go? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never
hurt me. Yeah,
so. That's what we grew up on, and now it's the...
Well, I mean, so is some of that partly coming from Chicago? I mean, folks from Chicago tend to be tougher than folks from Jersey.
I think also part of it's my Croatian Balkan genetics and blood. But you know, you mentioned these other parts of the world. Here in Mexico, where I am now, you're having also there's been a couple Mexican politicians now who have called a man a man. There's one Mexican politician who's a man who thinks he's a woman, and they've been now the government's gone after these people. So it's happening everywhere.
Why?
Yeah, because these conservative Mexican politicians called the trans guy a guy, and so the government said that now every day they have to for like a month or a few months they have to tweet an apology every day on Twitter. They have to take a re-education course.
A re-education course. Okay, I guess they have to fail biology. That's the mandate or what?
Yeah, something like this. And so it's absolutely insane that this is, you know, happening in Mexico. And you mentioned COVID. You talk about that in your book. And, you know, we don't have to get into the details. We all kind of know what happened or have our views. But just for me here is this is the greatest tyranny I've ever experienced in my lifetime. For me, it was like on par with living in a communist or fascist dictatorship, maybe a few steps removed. And I'm just boggled how so many people all across the world, but even in the U.S., complied. They went along with this, which is so un-American. And, you know, any thoughts on COVID?
Well, it's just, yeah, it was discouraging to see how easily people were stampeded into submission on COVID. You have so many levels of people turning into narcs. One of my favorite examples was in Massachusetts. I mean, they just, you know, Massachusetts has a lot of, informants. I mean, maybe from the ideology there, but one of my favorite cases was there was some guy who went to a strip club and filed a complaint that the stripper wasn't wearing a face mask. My experience, I was out, I'm trying to think what the terms that they had. It wasn't lockdown, quarantine, something like that. It wasn't house arrest, but I always, screw that. So, I mean, basically every weekend I was out hiking anyhow, and I'd be out hiking along there was a towpath close to D.C. National Park along the Sino Canal, and I'd be out there hiking, and it'd be fresh air, sunshine, wind, and people would literally be screaming and cussing at me because I wasn't wearing a face mask. And I was leading the hike once, coming up to a bridge there. There was some guy who was coming the opposite way, and he stopped and he stared at me and pointed and said, "You're not wearing a face mask." He was kind of holding his coat up and over his face like it was going to protect him. And I said, "Yep, that's true." And I kept walking. And then he says, "So what? You think your beard is your mask?" And so I said, and I kind of laughed and kept going. Then he turned around and yelled, "Your beard is ugly." I'm thinking, this is great. This is the kind of person who's wants to enforce the COVID mask mandates on a hiking trail, a wide hiking trail. It was, it was wide enough for mules to be pulling down a barge in the old days. So, but it's just, there were so many people that were satisfied because the COVID mandates gave them a chance to condemn everybody else who was not as subservient as they were.
Yeah, I think I was around the world when that happened in Kazakhstan, and then I came back to Mexico, and I think there was virtually no instance where I didn't get into an altercation or interaction when it came to go entering different establishments, not wearing my mask, wearing it under my chin, whatever. But do you think they'd be able to do something like COVID again? Would more people resist or not?
Well, Fauci is probably too old to send around the track again. I don't know. I would hope that people would learn and that people would have a sense of remorse for having been so docile, so submissive, for trusting, for putting government officials on a pedestal, for buying votary votive candles for Fauci and God knows who else. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I didn't think it would go that far. And I have memories, I guess it was late March 2020 when Maryland was starting to lock down. And there were a couple of really good libertarian guys I know. As you know, one had some good inside dope from the state government. And I was kind of like, what the hell is this? I mean, I just, it was astounding to me. And people forget that in D.C., Washington, D.C., they actually called out the National Guard, and I think they had them, you know, to stop people from going to the Cherry Blossom Festival. And it's like, or the Cherry Blossom Trees, the festival was canceled, I think. But, you know, it's so helpful if people have, you know, in my fantasy life, it would be good if people came out of that pandemic with a clearer conception of what the nature of government was. Government is edicts. Government is coercion. Government is very often simply idiocy. And it's, you know, government was withholding so much information from the start. I mean, if you look at it from the very first, you know, first month of the pandemic, if we had known that Fauci, NIH and others had bankrolled that research that came out of that lab, the government could, I don't think the government could have ever been put on a pedestal, because people would have said, well, this is the biggest government fuck up in modern history. Because, okay, you started a pandemic that killed millions of people. Well, you know, we were just doing some research. Yeah, well, good luck with that. But instead, it was like, well, it was from the wet market, you know, next door to the biological warfare lab, you know. I don't know, but to see how the critics were vilified and they were silenced in many cases, you know, it's ugly. And I don't know what they'll do next. So
it's, I guess we'll find out. And, you know, in your book, you talk about many other subjects, the police out of control, police killing, SWAT raids. I've had on the podcast the awesome John Whitehead of Rutherford Institute, where he talks a lot about that. You say SWAT attacks on American homes have been fueled by a federal arms buildup. You talk about the Tsars, the licensing, how the government, the managerial administrative state just keeps growing. You talk about subsidies, how it's basically centralized control and feudalism, means for politicians commandeering citizens' property to buy their submission. And, you know, maybe public schooling, to get your thought on that, because it goes back to what you were saying earlier, which is important, the next generation, the youth, you know, all of the totalitarians in the past focused on the youth, right? Hitler, Stalin. You talk about public schooling. I went to public school. I went to a private school in Croatia. I was a high school teacher. I was a university professor. Now I'm homeschooling my children. My kid is already, my kid's already bilingual, reading books to me, is a musician. And you talk about just one example in your book, National Council of Teachers of English, NCTE, asserted that teachers should teach kids to, instead of teaching English, right, to identify and disrupt the inequalities of contemporary life, including structural racism, sexism, consumerism, and economic injustice. Rather than requiring kids to read entire books, teachers should edify kiddies on immigration, xenophobia, police brutality, racism, and environmental degradation. I mean, it's total insanity. You mentioned also how, you know, there was a case, a lot of us know about this, how here you say the San Francisco Unified School District encourages teachers to refer to children's parents as caregiver one, caregiver two, instead of mother and father, and that FBI counterterrorism tools are now being used to target angry parents. And so schooling is just getting out of control. Thoughts on education?
Yeah, thanks very much for that. It was a very nice summary of some of the things that were most outrageous in that chapter, the Schools Gone Wild chapter. I did a piece recently for Libertarian Institute where I talked about my own time in public schools was the most brain-numbing time of my life, the most brain-deadening time. And there was such a sense of lost time and lost opportunity. And it's funny to see these teacher associations, the teachers of English, who kind of don't give a rat's ass about, you know, good books anymore. Instead, you know, you're going to be doing selfies and this, and there's other forms of being educated, whatever. But it doesn't take that much to teach someone how to read, but it's not being done. I mean, Baltimore, nearby here, the schools are just a complete disaster, and they end up blighting so many kids' lives. But, you know, what's really galling is that these teacher associations, it's not teaching kids about, you know, the dangers of white supremacy and capitalism and stuff like that. After they teach them how to read, this is instead of learning how to read. And I'm astounded that the teachers don't have a sense of decency, that they have failed the students in the most primary tasks. We're seeing the same thing in mathematics. If you look at what's going on now in California, I mean, where they've basically thrown standards overboard as a way to try to close the achievement gap. And they, you know, they aren't paying attention to the achievement gap between California and China, but on so many different levels, it's the government schools have turned into a horror show, and they're so focused on obedience, submission, and now more indoctrination perhaps than ever before, and more BS than ever before. It was a memory I had. Basically, it was almost like on the 2 days after I graduated from high school, boredom vanished from my life, and it's been gone almost ever since. And my love of reading came back because I had that when I was young. I lost it in school, but you know, the summer after I graduated from high school, boom, I started reading. Pulling stuff in like a vacuum, and that's how my mind. That was how my intellect awoke. Because it was dormant until then. So, but it's sad to see, and the transgender stuff, it's like starting in kindergarten and first grade, it's like, you know, so, I mean, life was a lot simpler when I was coming of age in the 70s, as far as gender, sex, you know, you knew what you wanted and you're probably going to pursue it like a heat-seeking missile. You know, you try and be polite and all that stuff, but I mean, this is what people were programmed for from their DNA. And instead, if you're the whole idea of encouraging kids to question their own gender before puberty, when they have no idea how their body works, this is a full employment program for therapists, and there's so much bad faith, and it's just, you know. It's almost like some theological quibble from 500 years ago where you encourage people to agonize and to feel like maybe they're damned and then to wear a hair shirt for the rest of their lives as penance. And it doesn't do, you know, any good. There's a tiny percent of folks who I think by birth are somewhat both genders, but that's probably less than 0.1%. But to make it fashionable, to make this a fashion. I mean, this is sadistic as all get out. Young people don't need this BS in their lives.
No, it's total madness. And some other subjects you broach again in your book, taxes, the IRS, we can go on and on about that. It's getting out of control. You mentioned how a couple of years back, Congress empowered the IRS to cancel the passports of Americans with alleged substantial tax delinquencies. I've got multiple passports, so I suppose even if they took away my U.S. passport, if I were leaving, I could still leave the country because I got other passports. But, you know, the Hunter Biden and his friends get away with anything, you know. Any other, key thoughts for you, key issues to get across, things that you're kind of angry about or worried about?
Well, there are issues I'm angry about. What I've tried to do in my writing and somewhat my persona is to bring the comic relief that's often in very short supply. I mean, there are plenty of things which outrage me, but I guess when I was first becoming writing about politics in the 1980s, there were a lot of conservatives and some liberals who were very proud of their anger, and they would flourish it like it was proof of their virtue. And it was just, most of them were very bad writers, and their anger was in lieu of good writing and clear thinking and hard evidence. I mean, there was a line I had. I forgot where it was. Sometime last couple weeks, I was doing a podcast with somebody, and maybe Ron Paul actually, and said that it would be good. It would be good if libertarians understood the policies that they oppose, because this is something which you're doing with your work and your podcast. You're educating people on the issues. I've met a lot of folks who think that simply being anti-government or hating the state is all they have to do, and then they're, you know, then they're got a halo over their heads. But there aren't that many hardcore freedom folks out there, not that many libertarian folks, and it's important to be able to explain the issues and to explain them in a way that's persuasive. And that's one of the things I've tried to do with the, you know, Last Rights, with the new book and with my books before, is provide people the intellectual ammo to fight for freedom. Because simply pounding the table is not going to get it done.
And that, I guess, leads me to another question. And any other thoughts on what we can do? You know, people ask me this. I sometimes join group Zoom calls where people from around the world are brainstorming. What can we do? And I go back to what someone told me once, who quoted Teddy Roosevelt: "Do what you can with what you got where you're at." You know, this digital technology kind of makes us think we can do so much, but I think we have to focus where we are locally, number one, most importantly. And then, you know, we can't save the world. We everyone's trying the best that we can. You know, any thoughts on key principles, things that we can do to sort of push back against tyranny?
Buy more books. That's the answer. I don't have a silver bullet. I wish I did. I mean, folks need to get better informed. Folks need to, you know, there's no substitute for courage, and self-reliance is a big part of that. I mean, there were a lot of folks that came up short during the pandemic and the lockdowns. And joining the herd stampedes to vilify anybody who didn't get vaccinated. I mean, it's just talking to folks in this area, in the Maryland suburbs of D.C., almost everybody got vaccinated. And there was a neighbor who works for the FDA. I had a couple neighbors here who worked for the FDA, and there was one who was, she was somewhat conservative. And so I was asking her, so I said, so tell me about these vaccines. Do you think folks should get them? And she paused and she stroked her chin. She said, "Well, you know, I think the COVID vaccine is worthwhile for people who are 85 years old or older." And I was thinking, okay, that's a pretty narrow group there. So, I mean, hell, it's an honest answer. There was another FDA employee who was asking me if I was vaxxed, and I just kind of said, "Eh." And she kind of stares in horror. But it's, folks, you know, people need to keep their minds awake, keep their courage up, be informed, and, you know, look for potential allies, but also watch out for the informants, because they're out there. There's probably a lot more here than in Mexico at this point, but I mean, there's a number of folks who I've seen fairly up close. It's just like, you know, trouble written all over them.
No, they're all over the place. This entrapment stuff and things like that. Any tip for writing, for writers, for people who want to start podcasts, blogs, write books?
Podcast, yours is excellent. I mean, I've dabbled with that, but you're light years ahead of me. On writing, read good writers. And that probably mostly means, people from earlier times. I mean, if you, someone like Henry David Thoreau was a wonderful stylist at his best. There was an essay I did for Counterpunch some years back entitled Losing Thoreau in Boston. I mean, It was. There are things in Thoreau where he almost makes a god of poverty, and the point which I was drawn, from my experience living in Boston, I said, if you haven't got enough money for a beer and condoms, you don't have enough money. So, but find the good writers, and most of them are older. To be able to write the clear prose, and to try to find ways to get good criticism for what you write, which is difficult to do. It was a struggle I had early on. I'm a college dropout, but before I dropped out of Virginia Tech, I took basically every writing course I could find there and then squeezed a number of professors to do independent studies because I knew I wasn't writing well enough. I don't know if there's a fine line between being self-critical and paralyzing yourself with that, or just to try to have the, to have the fire under your ass, not too high, but, to focus your mind to, to do better. So to write better. So.
And I guess one of my final questions is going back again on this march towards tyranny in the U.S. It feels like right now it's a slow burn. And it just feels like it's going to continue on as this slow burn. But again, studying history, I fear maybe there's like a moment. Was it Lenin that said years can happen in weeks or something like this? And so yep. if you sort of extrapolate, and any final thoughts on as your book title is, the death of American liberty. Any thoughts on?
Well, I mean, it's not foreordained. I mean, it doesn't have to die. I mean, if enough folks push back, if there's some, it's important to choose good ground to stand on for defensive purposes, and at some point to go on the offense against the government tyranny. But I wish I had better ideas in this question to answer your question, but I wrestle with this, and most of the answers, which I might have thrown out 10 years ago, I'm thinking, well, shit, that didn't work. So, folks have got to be tough, be well-informed, keep your mind active. I mean, it's a frustrating thing to see how reading ability has declined in the last 20 years. That's something that you might have experienced as a teacher, as a professor. Folks are just not getting the point as clearly as they did. And there's becoming more of an age gap on that. And that's kind of like, I had not foreseen that coming. But keep your minds active and strong and stay tough. So
that is a big issue, because if we have a citizenry that no longer reads, that doesn't have a certain level of intellect, they can't grasp the things that we're talking about. Again, that we're screwed, because then they can't understand anything, and they just default to what the government or the media.
Yeah, I mean, this is a huge problem I have with the government schools and like the civics classes there. Folks don't, there's a type of critical thinking which a person needs to have if they're going to be a good citizen in the sense of standing up for their own liberty and standing up to put a constitutional leash on the government. But if you don't have that critical ability, I mean, that's something which you might have got partly from your, ethnic background, because, I mean, there were so many fights which folks in your part of Europe had to survive, and wars and horrendous persecution. Some of my background is as a French Huguenot, and it's like, that was 400, 500 years ago, but, my ancestors got slaughtered. It's like, I ran to a lady from the French embassy at a reception once, and she was asking about my last name, and I said, yeah, it's French, and I said, yeah, my ancestors were Huguenots, and she says, oh, they were victims. I said, hell no, getting kicked out of France is the best thing ever happened to the Bovard family, and her jaw dropped, but, I mean, that's something that a lot of Americans have as their heritage. I think that I don't know how many are aware of that, but I mean, there's a lot of folks that came here because horrendous situation in other countries. And if there's a way to nourish that love of liberty, and maybe that's something you'd have ideas on, but I mean, joy of life is part of the nursing love of liberty, which is why I try to have the humor in the writing. But I mean, it's important not to get too dour. So, I mean, government sucks, but life is still entertaining.
It is. And that's part of what my solution I say as well. We have to be happy, always be joyful, laugh on our way to the gulag if it comes to that. And I remember as a history major writing a paper on the Waldensians, who were another persecuted religious group. Well, Jim, thank you for your work and for coming on. Your links will be in the description, but if you just want to tell us again where the best places to find you online, your projects, books, and so forth.
Great. Thanks. JimBovard.com. I've got links to the books there. Amazon's got a good book page, doing quite a bit lately for New York Post. Had a story in there yesterday, beating up in Biden on inflation, beating up the FBI there earlier this week on the FISA nonsense, spying on millions of Americans without a warrant. So, hey, thanks so much for having me on your podcast. And thanks for what you've done over years to help wake people up to the dangers to liberty.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our Pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.